K-12 Education Committee will come to order. We want to finish up the Jeff Johnson High Performance Teacher Reward Pilot Project Program. We've decided to call it a new name, calling it the Hyper Teacher Reward Program. High Performance Teacher Award Program. Hyper.
No one's appreciating.
You don't think our teachers can be hyper? All right. All right, bad joke. Representative Johnson, do you want to finish up? I know that there were some testifiers and maybe some responses to some of the concerns that they had and ways that, you know, maybe the bill.
I just have a couple of things to add, and then maybe we can open it to questions for me or others. One thing that I have recognized since yesterday in talking to both members and a couple teachers is that I think a lot of folks are under the impression that this is the same thing as what the governor first proposed, and it's quite different. And in fact, it's quite different from the bill as it was originally heard in the Senate even a few weeks ago. And I think people, and the reason that I recognize that is because a couple people in the last day have suggested to me that this is messing with PELRA and we can't get into that area. And this has absolutely nothing to do with PELRA. It's completely and totally voluntary on the part of a school district and on the part of the teachers and the union that represents those teachers. Everything is negotiated at the local level before anyone's even going to apply for this pilot project. And I think we need to keep that in mind. And kind of as an offshoot of that, one thing that Ms. Allswiger brought up yesterday was a big question and an important question for people, which is, when the school is first formed, what happens to all the employees? What happens to the teachers that are not chosen to remain at that in the pilot project? And that will need to be negotiated ahead of time with the union before the plan is even submitted. And I keep going back to that when these potential problematic issues are raised. This all needs to be determined ahead of time. Who has the authority to make those decisions? And if the union isn't willing to allow that authority to be had by the principal or someone else, then it's not going to happen. So it's voluntary, and I think that's important to keep in mind. Madam Chair, I just wanted to address those two issues, and now if you want to open it up to questions, that would be fine.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Are there questions? All right, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, a couple of questions. One, I'm wondering why you are not just going with the regular alternative compensation statute that we already have. It seems to be that's the variable, even though you've inserted quite a few more variables into your study, that the governor, at least, was trying to highlight. If we pay teachers $100,000 and they're in hard schools, will that make a difference? Why are you not just capitalizing on putting the money that you're putting into this into that with that criteria? Why do we need something new?
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, that is an option, I think, and it's certainly an option that we've talked about. It would have probably eliminated, as you said, some of the variables in here. I think the concept that the governor set forth was to try something new rather than just take something that exists now and change it. We could have done that. We conceivably could still do that. But I think the concept when it was originally presented was to let's kind of start fresh somewhere. It's probably going to be, well, it is going to be under this bill, an existing school. But let's allow that existing school to start over in a way that both the employees and the administration agree with. So it might be more strategic than anything else, frankly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, I'm concerned that with as many variables as you're introducing, that you won't get an answer on what happens when we pay teachers $100,000, because always when you have a fresh start school, there's a bump in achievement and everything else because everyone there is energized, working hard. They chose to come there. You have, anytime you have choice, which is why you and I support it, you get a certain synergy. And so I don't think the $100,000 part of it is going to be highlighted with the way you've introduced it. So I'd encourage you to consider putting it into the regular plan, and that would be a more authentic experiment, I believe. And then, Madam Chair, I had one other question. And I wish I could remember it now. Let's see. It's a long time last night. Maybe if we go over to Representative Eakin, I'll think of it.
Okay, well, let's see.
Madam Chair, can I just respond to one thing?
Yes.
I think, Representative Greiling, that's a valid point, although one of the reasons this is a five-year project is so that we don't just recognize a one- or even two-year bump, but that there needs to be sustained growth in order for us to say this is really worth it.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, I thought of it. Okay, thank you. Page 3, lines 4 through 6. This is the part, teachers at their discretion may spend added compensation on classroom or other expenditures. This is the part that Jan Alswiger said made her smile. It made me smile, too, having been a teacher for my first life after college. And my husband, I had to, hide from him how much I was spending on my students because he was so unhappy about it. What? You spent, another $100 on, food or classroom puzzles or things, can't you get your schools to pay for that? So, obviously teachers do that all the time, and one teacher that I recently had an email from who I read about last winter is making potholders to sell at the Day by Day Cafe on 7th Avenue to 7th Street in St. Paul to, make up for her kindergartner's milk money that isn't being funded by the state anymore after our cuts last year. So I'm wondering, is the intent here by putting this in here to say that even though teachers are going to get $100,000 or up to that at this school, really they're expected, though, to put it into the school, and that's going to be kind of an underlying understanding?
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Greiling, I'm not certain, and I might ask Kaz Anderson, she might be able to answer that question better than me. I'm not sure why the language is in there. I think I can safely say it's not in there as an expectation that teachers would spend the money in their classroom. And unless there's a really good reason to have it in there, I certainly am willing to take it out because I can see how it would cause people issues.
Thank you. I think that's a good idea.
Representative Greiling, and I think you made a good point, too. I know we've had some discussions in the past about alternative compensation and if teachers are deciding how they want their site to be compensated. I know I've heard teachers say that they would prefer, instead of having individual awards, to be able to plow it back into their sites. And it may be that that's what that language meant, was that instead of individual rewards, whatever the bonus amount of money was, they could put it back into maybe additional, they would decide on additional staff development seminars, or maybe they wanted to do some other kinds of curriculum things, or maybe they wanted to hire another paraprofessional. That may be where some of that genesis of it was, but I'm like Representative Johnson, I don't think any of us are really tied to that, but I think there was probably that idea also.
Madam Chair. Well, then, to me, we should be clear. What is this experiment about? Is it more money for a school and less rules and regulations, and then we want to see how they do? Or is it to pay teachers more, and we want to see how they do? Because they were paid more, and then they chose to go to a hard school rather than avoiding a hard school. I think there's a lot of mixed things in here, and then we won't get any answer at all. And I would say that the one about paying teachers more, although it's controversial within the teachers and the teachers' union, it would be worth finding out the answer to if we then meant to apply that research afterwards. If we found out by paying teachers $100,000 that, that does make a huge difference for students and how they're learning and how the teachers feel about how hard they want to work at a hard school, and if we were prepared then with that answer to actually apply that and put more money into schools and therefore enable all schools to apply that answer so that all teachers had opportunities to earn more money, commensurate with the hard job that teaching is, then I would look more favorably upon this bill. But it just seems to me the governor scored points by saying he wanted to reward teachers that went to hard schools with large salaries, but now we don't have that concept even here, you know, in a clear way in the bill.
Madam Chair, and Representative Greiling, the bill is not just about paying teachers more. The bill is about paying teachers in certain schools more who can show that there is a value added, there is a performance increase to their kids. So it's not just the concept of paying teachers $100,000 and does that help. I think it's a bit deeper than that. And I can't answer the question as to whether we'd be willing to act on this if we believe that it works based upon this five-year pilot. I hope we'd be willing to act on it. But I hope there's not a misunderstanding that this is just not a question of if we pay teachers more, do they do better. It's about whether paying teachers more based upon a value-added assessment and allowing local control, and not local control, based management makes a difference. It's not simple, but I think it's important for us to find that out. I'd be willing to add that.
Representative
Keegan. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was thinking that, you know, maybe we could do a pilot project a little closer to home here. I was thinking maybe we could do a super legislator pilot program. And I was thinking that it would probably make it more relevant to us if we could see how it would affect us if we tried to do a similar thing right here. I think that we would, first of all, have a lot of difficulty trying to determine how you would classify what a super legislator is. I think we would have different interpretations as far as what standards should be used. For instance, I may use, you know, fiscal responsibility is one of the leading criteria in determining whether you should be a super legislator or not. My guess is others may disagree and have other criteria. And I also think that it would be difficult to assess how much of an impact it would have actually on the legislature. You think that having one or a handful of legislators being paid a much higher salary would change the workings and operations of the government? It seems to me that if it doesn't work, you know, using that analogy, I don't see how it's going to work in the schools if we're going to have, you know, one teacher or even a couple of teachers that's going to save a whole school. It seems like it takes a team effort. And I don't think that one legislator, for instance, is going to, you know, make our state any more fiscally responsible.
Well, good luck with that bill.
Representative Tiger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Eakin, I like your thoughts there. But just a couple of things here in regards to the super teacher, and Representative Greiling touched upon it as well. I taught school for many years, and I think the state of Minnesota will stand out on this and doing a lot of volunteer work. I've coached kids wrestling for 28 years for nothing. I've coached basketball many years for nothing. I've done summer programs where kids have failed in school, and I donate my time to get these kids to school. And I don't think I'm any better than a lot of teachers I've taught with. I've done the extra. And I think I like your concept, Representative Johnson, and my question is directed at you. I like the idea where you're going to single out a teacher. Now, being in Minnesota is number one in math proficiency and testing. We're up near the top in reading proficiency. We have the best graduation rate in the state of Minnesota. In a nation, we are near the top in a lot of areas. Shouldn't we be rewarding all of the teachers for doing such a great job? Now, why just single out one super teacher when Minnesota is in the forefront and has been for years? Why don't we go a step beyond and say, hey, we're not going to just pick out a single teacher. Let's give all the teachers a big raise for doing a good job, because look at the results. We're really doing a good job. Why limit it to one super teacher?
Madam Chair, Representative Heidkirchen, the first response that comes into mind is the dollar sign. Obviously, that's probably not an option this year. But another really important point here is you say that the state is doing very well when it comes to math scores. We have a very good education system in Minnesota. But all we've been talking about, not all we've been talking about, but what we've been talking about a lot the last year or two is the gap, the achievement gap, and that some kids are not doing well. And this bill is, in a small way, trying to see whether this helps address that problem. There's a cost to it. There's no question about that. And if we were to try to do this with every school in the state, it would be a prohibitive cost. So that's why we're starting small.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, is there anything in your bill that limits the opportunity for teachers any place along the line? Is everybody eligible to try to participate in this super teacher, quote-unquote, type of concept?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, yes. Any teacher can apply.
So it's open to any teacher. Is there anything in this bill that, that lowers compensation or changes anything for a teacher if they don't want to take part?
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, no. What could happen, the issue that Ms. Allswager brought up yesterday, which again is a fair issue, if an existing school becomes a pilot, there may be some teachers in that school who are not chosen to stay in that school. I'm assuming, based upon the negotiation that would have to take place before that, they would remain employees of that school district with all of the same collective bargaining rights that they had before. They would just be probably at a different school. So that is the, I mean, that's the one risk that would be there.
Okay, but in essence, what this does is create an opportunity for teachers who would choose to participate or choose to apply for this, an opportunity for them to try to really step out above. And it would also direct those who wanted to do that, it would direct those energies to areas where a student achievement has been shown to be less, and we all know we got the achievement gap that we're trying to close. So it would give an opportunity for teachers, without taking away from those who don't want to participate, an opportunity for those who do to, number one, increase their compensation, number two, rise above, so to speak, and put those efforts toward kids. And that's really what this is all about, isn't it?
That's right. Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, that's correct.
So, in your opinion, by not being in favor of this bill, are you we saying we don't want to give teachers the opportunity to do that, and we're not trying to direct those best in that opportunity toward the gap? Would you say that that's what that would be saying, in your opinion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't know if I'd say that or not, but I think that this is a great opportunity for teachers, and when you mention that it's an opportunity for a teacher who wants to make more money, potentially make more money, to go ahead and apply and become part of this, the key there is potentially make more money. They still have to show results based upon whatever plan was negotiated before the application was filed.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Representative Hager.
Yes, just a follow-up on that. I still have a hard time understanding the intent of this bill. I realize that, you know, statewide we've done very well, but yet when you look at Representative Johnson, where do we stand on teachers' pay in comparison to the rest of the nation?
Madam Chair, Representative Hager Green, I don't know.
Okay.
Apparently you do.
My understanding is I believe we're not in the top half. But yet our results are well above, except for a little area. And the problem that I have with the Department of Education is that they'll find something negative and dwell upon it, rather than talk about all the positives. I like looking at the positive things we're doing in the state of Minnesota. We're doing a lot of good things. I think the teachers are doing a lot of good things. But we find something a little bit negative, and we right away point at that. Now, what are we going to do about that? Because our norms are so high, because the results are so high, of course there's going to be some certain areas where there's going to be some, the differences are going to be greater. I would like to see a printout on exactly why a certain area of the state of Minnesota is not doing as well. I know we have had an influx of among, we have an influx of different nationalities. And of course that's going to bring our numbers down. I know it does in Melrose and in the Wilmer area with the poultry plants. We have a lot of Hispanics that are moving in directly from Mexico. And again, that's going to bring the results down in the long run. And again, that's not really attributable to what's happening there. But I have a problem with the intent of this. We just single out just a portion, when on the whole, we're doing well.
Madam Chair, Representative Hager, I guess I don't understand why you see this bill as a negative thing. And when you suggest that the purpose behind it is to point out a little negative thing or a little problem, I think you said. This is not a little problem. The problem, the issue of underperforming kids, particularly in high poverty areas, is a huge problem. And what we're trying to do here is try something different. As I mentioned yesterday, everybody seems to agree that it's a problem, But sometimes the only answer of some folks is more money, but please don't change how we do things. I think we need to look at how we do things as well. This is going to find out, help us determine whether doing it this way might help. But that's all we're trying to do.
Madam Chair, but is this not more money?
Madam Chair, yes it is. That's what I pointed out, that more money might be an element of that. But more money alone is certainly not solving the problem, so we need to do more.
All right. I think we've discussed the bill. It's laid over for consideration. And we also have listened to some of the concerns about it, and I know that Representative Johnson has worked a long time on trying to make this a more understandable and workable bill, and I'm sure he'll take some of those suggestions to heart if we go forward. The next thing that we want to finish up is the document that we have. It's not a bill, it's a document. And we were just kind of going through some of the different sections, and we want to finish that up today and get members' questions answered on some of the proposals. And Ms. Anderson, we were at the agency's thing? Okay. You want to kind of continue? I think we finished with the agency things, and we're on to the state academies. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name for the record is Chaz Anderson, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Education. And I think we were had a spirited conversation about contracting, and I noticed that Representative Goodwin walked out of the room, but we can start with the academies and then go to contracting. We do have more specific information for the committee to look at as it relates to the agency's contracting for fiscal year 03 and 04.
Okay, when she comes back in, since that is something she was concerned about, we'll go back to that. Why don't you just continue going through?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the governor is recommending a $31,000 reduction for the Minnesota State Academies. As you know, the governor has recommended for most agencies a 3% reduction, with exception of small agencies, the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections. This is one of them that received that exception. It's a 0.3% reduction for the academy. Subdivision 4 is a reduction for the Purpich Center for the Arts. It's $179,000. That is a 3% reduction for them.
I do want to go back to the Department of Education's budget. I noticed that on your 3% reduction, though, that you are also allowing the department to reduce the Board of Teaching, the Board of Administrators, and the student organizations by a 3% reduction also. Would that have to come out of do they have like a specific budget, or are they run by the licensure fees that the teachers and the administrators, how would that work?
Madam Chair, the fees that are collected by the Board of Teaching and the Board of School Administrators is deposited into the general fund. They don't have a dedicated account. And they are then given an appropriation, and so the reduction would come from the appropriation that is given for the Board of School Administrators and the Board of Teaching. The reductions that a 3% would mean for them, the Board of Teaching, that would result in a $16,226 reduction. The Board of School Administrators would be a $4,950 reduction, and the student organizations would be a $5,100 reduction.
And the basic operating costs for these are what, some staff people, would their salaries be reduced, or what, how would they?
Madam Chair, I can't speak to the Board of School Administrators, but I know the Board of Teaching does have carry forward, and it's more than they pay for three staff. I believe their appropriation is I think it's about $650,000, and that pays for three staff, some grant activities, boards members, per diem, and travel. So it will come out of that that budget that they have.
So they have some carry forward then?
Yes.
But you don't know about the Board of Administrators, if they have some carry forward?
Madam Chair, I'm going to have Ms. McGlone talk about the Board of School Administrators.
I'm sorry, what did you say, Ms. Anderson?
The Board of School Administrators budget is, in fiscal year 04, it's $165,000. I'm not really sure what their carry forward is. They do employ two staff. They have a director and an assistant. They do have expenses related to members of the board and per diem and travel, as well as the Board of Teaching has.
And the student organizations, do they have carry forward?
No, they have a direct appropriation that funds are flowed out to the organizations that they do have staff as well. I do want to add on the Board of School Administrators, they also have $21,730 that is dedicated for professional technical contracts. The agency does provide service to both the Board of School Administrators and the Board of Teaching. We do not have an agreement with the Board of School Administrators because their budget is so small, and the functions that we do for them, give them supplies, give them support for payroll and other things, we don't charge them for. The Board of Teaching we provide much more service to, and we do have the department does have an interagency agreement with the board to provide staff time and other services to them.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Viskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I carried the legislation which created the Board of Administrators, and the one thing that we were very careful in crafting the legislation was that to the state budget, it would be a zero-sum game. In other words, the Board of Administrators would be funded entirely through the fees that administrators would pay on their license. And so if we were to see a reduction in the board, one would assume then there would have to be a corresponding reduction in the fees that the administrators would pay to the board to keep it at a zero-sum game. No, if we see a reduction in this number to the board, then we'd have to see a corresponding reduction in how much we'd ask the administrators to pay so that it remains a zero-sum game.
Madam Chair, Representative Viskins, to that issue, right now the fee does not actually pay for the services. It's a mandatory fee if you're an active administrator. It's optional if you're not an active administrator. And we do not collect enough fees to pay for the services currently. And sometimes that's related to a startup. It's a relatively new board. Sometimes people don't realize they need to pay. There's issues about that. But currently, right now, the fee does not pay for the activities that the board undertakes.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Anderson, if it doesn't, then there's a flaw, because that was the intent of the program, and so if it's not working out, then who's ever in charge of oversight there needs to make an adjustment, because that's the way it was written, and that's the way I remember even in last year's budget that we passed, it came out to a zero-sum game. We were expecting to collect the same amount of fees as the board was to have expended. And so, you know, whether or not it does is more of a management issue than intent of the legislation, I would think.
Representative Erickson.
Well, Madam Chair and Ms. Anderson, what is the salary of the executive director of the Board of Administrators, and also what is the salary of the executive director of the Board of Teaching? Because that may account, Representative Biskins, for some of this question.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I believe the run on that would show that the executive director of the Board of Teaching makes in the low 80s, and the executive director of the Board of School Administrator makes in the mid 60s.
Okay. Mid 80s. Okay, so we just need some clarification on that. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead and go on with the State Academy?
Madam Chair, I have no further comments on the reductions for the academies and the Perfect Center of the Arts. We can go on to the next provision if you wouldn't mind.
All right.
Going on to the bill, sections 5 through 8 are language from the transfer for the lead abatement that I discussed yesterday. Section 9 simply it clarifies kindergarten, meaning that kindergarten is designed to be a program that students progress to the first grade. This is something that I discussed yesterday, so it's clear that a pre-kindergarten program is not a kindergarten program for purposes of entering into the student accounting system, and that a kindergarten program must be designed to have the student progress to the first grade. Section 10 and 11 of the bill, I'm going to turn over to Ms. Carol Hokanson to discuss. It's transportation provisions related to homeless students.
My name is Carol Hokanson. I'm from the Division of Program Finance of the Department of Education. Section 10 on page 10, lines 29 through 36, would provide funding for additional costs associated with transporting homeless students living in a non-shelter location to their original school of attendance. This would be funded through the special education funding formula. Federal law requires that school districts transport homeless students to their original school of attendance if the parent requests, and federal funds are not available to provide for this additional expense. So, and current state funded transportation doesn't cover the costs. For example, a student becomes temporarily homeless, has residence, temporary housing in St. Paul, but were originally in Anoka School District. They are entitled under federal law to go back to Anoka School District. And so the district of residence would be required to transport that student from St. Paul back to Anoka.
Okay, and we do have another amendment that is the A5 amendment. Do you have, is that in everyone's packet? Okay. And this is just some further clarification on that issue. And that was actually pointed out to us by Mary Gilbert, and they've worked with the department on that. Do you have the A5, Ms. Hawkinson?
Yes, we do.
Okay. And then if you want to go ahead and explain that additional, that would be nice.
What this amendment is doing is there are really two types of homeless students. Those that are homeless in non-shelter locations are covered under the amendment that I was originally describing. What this amendment is doing, these students are located in shelters and are considered care and treatment under the care and treatment law. And what that means is that the resident district is responsible for transportation. But the resident district is where the shelter is located. So what this is doing, we have a little bit of a disconnect going on in the homeless. They're treated a little bit two different ways. So this is really lining up the transportation requirements to where the resident district would be responsible, or in this case, the district that enrolls them, which is under 127A.47 subdivision 2. Under Minnesota law, it says that for a homeless student, the district that enrolls them is the district of residence. So this is really lining up the transportation to where the district of residence is always responsible to provide the transportation. But this goes a little bit further unless there's an agreement between the two districts.
All right. Any questions about that? All right. We want to move this amendment, A5. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to move to Section 11. Section 11 pertains to how districts should allocate their transportation costs. And for lines 25 through 35, what it's doing is specifying that salaries and fringe benefits of district employees whose primary duties are other than transportation should not be included in transportation expenditures. And then just a little bit further, lines 36 on page 11, and then 1 through 5 on page 12, this requires districts to document the time if they have employees who are going to be reported part-time for transportation funding. What we have noted over the last few years is that there's been increased transportation costs, particularly in special education. And special education is one of the few areas where if you increase your costs, you increase your funding. And a lot of this cost has been attributed to districts, including salaries of district-wide staff that really are not working on transportation issues. Lines 6 through 23 on page 12 It's standardizing the transportation cost allocations for district-owned bus services and contractor-owned transportation services.
Representative Brown,
you have a question? Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hokanson, I know that the bus director for Roseville Area Schools was here yesterday, and he was hoping to testify for this, but he left me a note, and I think Ms. Hokanson is aware of it. On lines 9 and 10, it says allocating these costs per mile or cost per student. And according to Jan Vanderwall, a lot of school districts do their bus route costs on an hourly basis. So he's suggesting, and I wonder if this would be a friendly amendment, or otherwise I would move it, that we add in addition to per mile or cost per student, say, or per hour or per route.
Okay. Ms. Hokanson, do you have a comment about that?
We would be agreeable to that. That is also a common practice for some school districts to allocate their costs that way.
Okay. Okay. So why don't you go ahead and move that?
Okay. Madam Chair, I would. On line 10, it says, after cost per student, insert, or per hour or per route.
Okay, I'll got that amendment. Any questions on that? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposition, the amendment is adopted. All right, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on lines 6 through 23 on page 12, what this is doing is standardizing the transportation cost allocations for district-owned bus services and contractor-owned transportation services. Currently, district-owned bus services have to allocate in a lot more detail, and contractor-owned don't have to have as much detail. And what the department has noted over the years is that districts who have contracted-owned bus services have disproportional costs for those categories of transportation that are cost-based, for example, special education and non-public. And what this amendment is really doing is treating both types of services equally, so they are one isn't at a disadvantage to the other for funding.
All right. And just for the public, we will come back, and if the public has any concerns or anything about any of these topics, we will open that up to the public and, you know, let you come forward to make comments and, as soon as we get kind of through this document. All right, go ahead. Ms. Anderson, are you doing the next?
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Just a minute. We've got one question on the bus stuff. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question I have regarding this allocation of costs. I know in some of our school districts, like in one of my school districts, we don't have a transportation director. The superintendent does that. Is this intended to not allow him or either the superintendent to allocate a part of their salary to transportation, or would they still be able to do that?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, they would be able to do that because we are allowing, if they're working part-time in transportation, to document their time. And they would be able to report those costs.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, if there are no further questions on the transportation provisions, we'd like to go to the early childhood learning readiness provisions in the bill, if that's okay with you.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, sections 12 through 18 amend the school readiness language to reflect a concentration on preparing preschool children for kindergarten. And we focus the program requirements on the development and assessment of academic skills and also try to improve district accountability. The current statutory language for this program, the language is really broad, and we're trying to kind of hone it in to look at academic preparation. And you can see on subdivision, in section 12 and subdivision 1, the eligibility is simply for by age, 3.5-year-olds to kindergarten age. Subdivision 3 lays out the program requirements. It simplifies some requirements in that it simplifies the language. It doesn't make the requirements less stringent. It just talks about, I think it's better language than the old language. This program has been around since the 80s, and that, if you remember, that decade was there was a lot of collaboration language and a lot of kind of social service, family-oriented language in this bill that we are trying to kind of streamline here and make more consistent with the mission of the department right now. Section 14.
Representative. I just have a request, if I could, of the testifiers, if you could give us the page number and the section. It'd be a lot easier for me to follow because there's a lot of sections that and subdivision numbers.
Madam Chair, so the section I just talked about was on page 13. And at the bottom of page 13 is section 14, which then amends some of the program and application requirements. Section 15 on page...
I'll send on the section 14.
Yes.
The process right now for school readiness, do they have to have a plan? And does it have to be submitted to the commissioner for approval, or do they just have to have a plan that's on record?
Madam Chair, they do have to have a plan. There's a document, this many pages, mostly chart form, that the districts have to fill out, they have to complete before they can get their aid. So the commissioner has to approve the plan. And we do currently withhold the aid until the plan is satisfactory. So that isn't changing in this. However, the plan is getting a little more simplified.
Did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, in section 14, page 14, line 11, actually lines 8 through 13, I'm wondering what the department's rationale is for changing the process for withdrawal of funds if a program is seen as not complying with the requirements. I don't have the language of 127A.42 in front of me now, but it appears from having reviewed it yesterday that it's basically a due process sort of language, that if the department believes that a program is out of compliance, you notify the school district, you tell them what the problem is, you give them time to remediate, and if they don't, then you pull the plug. Seems appropriate. And this seems to get rid of the due process component and just pull the plug. And I'm wondering if you could explain the rationale behind the language.
Madam Chair and Representative Gavney, it is not the intent to circumvent any due process. This was just simply a matter of tightening the language. It does add, as I said, we have already have the language that we can not approve until the plan is complete. This language then does go a step further, though, on withholding the aid if it's not satisfactory. But we would go back and forth with the district over the plan in a consultant way to get it up to speed.
Madam Chair, you know, I certainly have no problem with the department enforcing statute. I think the question is how, and my concern being that your intent seems to be aligned with current statute.
Correct.
But once we pull that statute out, the underlying language isn't there, and it seems then that statute and intent aren't aligned. And I'm confused.
I'm just trying to. It says notwithstanding provisions of section 127A.42. That's the 127A.42 is the reduction of aid for violation of law.
Understood.
And then, and then pursuant to 124D.16 is school readiness aid.
Mm-hmm.
So without proceeding according to section 127A.42, at any time the commission determines the program does not comply. So.
Madam Chair, if I could add something I think that will help Representative Dabney and procedures before we withhold aid at the department.
Please.
When we conduct an audit and have a finding, the school district or charter school has 30 days to appeal the decision, or they can get an extension on the 30 days. And then we conduct a hearing with the affected party, and that is essentially their appeal, and we make a final decision then for the commissioner. If they are not satisfied with that remedy, then they can go to the Court of Appeals and have the decision remanded for further consideration by the department. So there are procedures, guidelines we have in place before aid is withheld.
Ms. Anderson, just that seems like an awful lot of process for s- some very small amount of money. I mean, I can understand. I mean, why wouldn't you just have the regular process of 127A42, you know, the due process, whatever. If why would you want to not just do that regular process with the school readiness instead of going through a court of appeals and all of that? I just...
Madam Chair, any time that a school district feels that an administrative decision is in the wrong, they have the right to go to the court of appeals.
I understand that, but you're saying, notwithstanding the sections of 127A42, which is, you know, the process that's set out for dispute violations, hearing, whatever, and you're saying, you know, you don't want to do that now for this, that you, so I don't know why you would just want to follow the same process for withholding or and just have that. I mean, we're doing that with everything else. I mean, we've had some discussion in this committee this year about withholding with charter schools, and we're following 127A. We're referencing that back to make clear that there's due process, and I don't understand why you wouldn't want to just do that with the school readiness process too. I'm just asking the question.
Madam Chair, we can take a look at that.
Okay,
and provide
I guess
some alternative language.
I guess I would suggest that, you know, I think Representative Daphne brings a good point that let's just have consistency. If we're going to be talking about withholding aid, let's just follow the process for everything in the same manner. I think that's easier for everyone, unless you've got some other rationale for it that, you know, we're not understanding. Okay,
thank
go
you
ahead, Ms. Carlson.
Let's see, we're at section 15, page 14. The section about services with new or existing providers, as you know, school readiness and ECFE are public, so to speak, pre-kindergarten services, but there certainly is a wealth of private pre-kindergarten services, and we do not want to preempt those from being eligible to receive some money to focus more on school readiness. And so we want to continue that practice, as is current practice. But we haven't required a lot of school districts, because there isn't a great deal of money in some districts for this program, they do contract with private providers. We are now asking that they give us a copy of that contract. We haven't had that before, so we really don't know what they're contracting for, and this would let us know that. The supervision section, we're simply deleting that language at the bottom because it's redundant. It's in all contracts anyway, so we don't really need it in statute. The going to page 15, the program fees, we're amending this language, saying that the districts must adopt a sliding fee schedule rather than may, to make it consistent with, you'll recall, last session we did that with the ECFE program, and we didn't do it with the school readiness, so now they're consistent. The amount of aid, let's see, there's a renumbering in the aid section, and that's about it.
Okay. Any questions now on the rest of this? Okay, thank you. Oh, Representative.
Madam Chair, I'm curious, is this the program that we were talking about at one point to allow us a percentage of compensatory dollars to be used for readiness programs?
No, we talked about allowing compensatory dollars to be used for early childhood programs.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But this doesn't apply in this case.
No. Madam Chair, Representative Sikora, let's see. The compensatory aid may be, and we'll have that provision come up later, we'll talk about it here, may be used for pre-kindergarten services. This would be among that, but not restricted to school.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Carlson,
this is strictly the readiness program that's now in existence.
Correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if there's no other question, I think
Representative Heiger can have a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification is we talked about the transition aid with the pre-kindergarten kids getting in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I know, yesterday. Is it possible that some school districts are also getting school readiness program money as well as this?
Madam Chair and Representative Heiger, Absolutely, yes. The districts are getting...
So in other words, they could be getting extra monies because they're counting per pupil unit. The pre-kindergarten kids are getting those funds as well as these other funds.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, all districts are getting school readiness money based on the aid eligibility, which is, you know, half, it's like half of your four-year-olds and half of your four-year-olds who are eligible for free and reduced funds. So some districts are getting, there are probably almost 60 districts that are getting less than $5,000 for this program. We're not talking about a lot of money. Minneapolis, I think, is getting a little bit over $1 million. So, but everybody does is able to pull this aid down also.
Right. Ms. Anderson, go ahead.
Okay. If there are no further questions, we'll go to Section 19 on page 15 and 16. That is just the transition revenue that we talked about for the pre-kindergarten program for the districts that were collecting per pupil funding for the pre-kindergarten four-year-old program. As I discussed yesterday, that would be a hold harmless. The districts would get transition revenue to keep them at fiscal year 04 levels. Section 20, I'm going to give it to Ms. Carlson. This discusses the comp ed issue with early childhood.
Ms. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, this section then is what Representative Sikora just referred to. This is allowing districts to use up to 10% of their compensatory aid for pre-kindergarten programs, and that may be pre-kindergarten programs of their choosing. On page 18 is the language, notwithstanding paragraph A, a district may allocate up to 10% to support pre-kindergarten programs. And the section 22 language on page 19 then says that this compensatory aid must be used for activities that prepare children ages 3.5 to kindergarten entrance for kindergarten. And again, districts may contract with other providers of pre-kindergarten services to do this.
Representative Bernardi, you had a question.
Yeah, I had a question before we went on to this new area. I see they fixed something with transition revenue. Has the governor, what is your, are you going to fix the transition revenue problem for the districts that are not guaranteed their 2003 classroom dollars? Have you made any decision on that?
Ms. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, the governor is recommending no other changes to the transition revenue at this time.
Okay, just so the public knows, there's a number of school districts, and there are school districts with growing poverty, and they're mostly rural districts and some inner ring districts that do not have guaranteed funding at their 2003 level like all the other schools do. And we would like it fixed, and it's $3.5 million that basically was used to balance the state budget on the backs of our rural districts with growing poverty and our inner ring suburban districts. And I hope we can fix this two-tier funding system so that all schools will have the same kind of guarantee for their 2003 classroom dollars, and that other school districts, so that our school districts don't get that same guarantee, and that we now have local control taken away from us because we're given restricted dollars that aren't guaranteed. So I'm very frustrated with it, and I hope that you can please work with the governor to fix this, so we have a one-tiered funding system and not a two-tiered funding system.
Representative Fiskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess if we go back where we're at, I believe now is page 18. At the bottom of the page there, lines 33 to 36, and I'm going to be very careful here, being cognizant that I am a math teacher and linguistics aren't always my forte, but boy, that's confusing to me as I read this. Notwithstanding paragraph A, a district may allocate up 10% of the amount of compensatory revenue district receives to support kindergarten programs under subdivision 2A, which seems like it goes back to paragraph A. So I guess I'm not quite sure of the intent of that language. So if we could have a clarification. Well, here, is the intent of that language to allow a school district to retain up to 10% of the district's total compensatory dollars to create pre-kindergarten programs anywhere in the district? Is that the intent of this language?
Ms. Carlson?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, yes, that's correct. Since the preschool children aren't at a specific school site, that they're not able to generate, if you will, their own compensatory revenue. So this language is saying it doesn't have to be site-specific, but that the district may allocate up to 10% of its entire compensatory.
Representative Biskens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then what I guess we need to be clear about, all right, is that this is a fundamental shift in philosophy of the use of compensatory dollars. Compensatory dollars has been used to fund low-income children to get them up to speed. All right. Now we're saying, well, we'll give you the money, and 90% of it yet still does that, but now we're going to fundamentally shift 10% of it for a different philosophy. We're going to fund it for pre-kindergarten programs, and we're not, whether or not the students are low-income students. Am I correct in that interpretation?
Ms. Carlson?
Madam Chair and Representative Biskens, the intent of using the compensatory education aid for pre-kindergarten children is to target the children who are not yet ready for school. It is to target the pre-kindergarten children that would, if you will, be part of the achievement gap since they're not ready for kindergarten.
At this point, Madam Chair.
Representative Sakura.
Would this be then children that you find in the screening process that we do when they're 3 1/2 that might need the extra help? Is that how
Madam
you
Chair and Representative Sakura, yes. If children are screened at 3 1/2 and found to, they would definitely be candidates for this. Some of the children aren't screened until later, but we would catch them along the way, and the intent is to stay with the intent of compensatory language, and just the population is what's opening up here to kids under kindergarten age.
Ms. Carlson, to Representative Biskens' point, it might be good to clarify that the compensatory would have to be targeted to those students
unprepared.
However you want to write the language, but I think it would be better to do that instead of opening it wide open, because you do want to make sure that it is. So I would suggest, Representative Biskens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But to even, I think, a more specific issue, all right, and this is what I argued before, is that compensatory, it just makes more sense to fund programs to help kids catch up, irrespective of their income. Right, which is what I believe you're saying here,
right,
with this 10%, is that the income, we're not going to look at the income of these pre-kinder, we're going to look at whether or not they need help catching up, right? And I think that's appropriate.
The sliding fee would take care of the fact that they're higher income, they pay a larger fee. Is there a sliding fee in this program? Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Sephora, what is your question?
Well, I agree with Representative Biskens in that what we want to do is target the children who aren't prepared, not just look at maybe the population that is free and reduced lunch that we normally look at. If they turn out in the screening to be unprepared or need special help, then these are the children that we would try to help through this. But I thought if there is also then, if some of them turn out to be higher income kids who need help, if there's a sliding fee program, then they would pay more for that program.
Representative, I think there's two different things going on here. We talked about school readiness program, but this is adding an additional use for compensatory.
Right.
This is not connected with the school readiness program.
No, I understand that.
Okay. I mean, this is just saying another use for compensatory could be to create programs to support pre-K. And I think Biskens' comment was well taken, that, you know, we should make sure that it is very targeted to those kids that would need it and not be just opened up to any child. So I think that's an issue. I'm not sure about the sliding fee thing as far as if you're, then if you want to,
okay, forget I said it.
I don't know. For Pat and Riley, maybe you can make a comment here.
Madam Chair, I don't know about that. I seem to be confused today, but I'll try. I'm looking at, I have the same concern, but maybe with a different conclusion as Representative Biskins, that we're raising money on one premise and then spending it on another. I think we have to make sure that how we raise the money is how it's spent. And if there's the legislative will to change how we raise the money, that's one thing, but I don't think it's fair to have not made that policy decision but to start spending money in a different way. It may be a moot point because the children who are on free and reduced lunch almost always are the ones who need to catch up, and there may be others as well, and if we want to allocate money for them, then you know, I'm fair game for that. And if kids are you know, doing well and they're also on free and reduced lunch, often when they're in high concentrations, however, you know, the whole boat is rises by this funding. But my specific question, and that in addition to the bait and switch, which I think this is, I'm concerned on lines 14 and 15. Not only are we now going to not use the money how it's raised, but we're also giving it to non-resident children and private preschools. And that's really major, I think. And I want some discussion as to why we're doing that. We raise money for children who live in a district who are on free and reduced lunch, and then we turn around and give it not only to kids who aren't, but also to non-resident students and private school preschools. Often private school preschools draw from a much wider range than just you know, some of the ones that are kind of connected with the schools. And they could be expensive private preschools compared to some of the public preschools. And then we're going to divert this money that's very needed for free and reduced kids to those schools. Why are we doing this?
All right. Ms. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Representative Grayling, this idea came from a discussion that the Commissioner and Representative Sikora and the Governor's Office had out at a Governor's Conference. And the intent, as we said, is to stick with the issue of kids who are underprepared to learn and to progress in school. This is for preschool children to do that. As we know, preschool isn't a public, there isn't a public system for preschoolers. So there is a mix of private and public options for preschool children. This, when this was discussed, it was acknowledged that we have good programs out there, some of which are private programs for children, some of whom do a good job at targeting children that need help getting ready for kindergarten, and we did not want to preclude them from this. The district using this money doesn't have to turn all its money over to a private provider. It can contract a part of the tuition, or however, you know, it best sees fit to do that. It could infuse some of that money to a private provider if it wants to, or, you know, it can, it really leaves it open for the district to do what they see best to target these kids to get them ready for school.
Ms. Representative Sikora?
I'd just like to speak to this concept in general. I don't think over the years we've seen a great deal of evidence that compensatory, as we are now distributing and using it, is making a huge difference in the performance of the students that we're trying to help. It's kind of like Title I money. We haven't seen a huge increase in the performance or anything of children at that level. I think we've also learned a lot over the last few years about the importance of early childhood programs and the importance of children when they're younger having an opportunity to have their, you know, brain developed, stimulated, et cetera, and to be prepared for kindergarten. So it seems to me that taking 10% of this and putting it out there, and I'm not saying I think we should start a big public program of pre-kindergarten. I don't buy into that at all. But I think using what we have, there are some community ed programs that are actually offering nursery school programs at this time. I'm familiar with a couple of them. There are also a lot of private programs. There are Montessori's that seem to do a pretty darn good job. There are a lot of private nursery school programs out there, public nursery school programs. There are child care providers like, I'm trying to think of Tudor Town and some of those that do child care that actually have some pretty good programs and, of course, would be required to meet certain specifications in order to do this. But I think that this would be a very good way to check, to see what can happen with some of our compensatory. And if this works, we don't have so many students needing compensatory when they're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, etc. It seems to me we should try this, see what kind of a difference it makes, and maybe it's a save. We always talk about saving for the future, guys. This is, in my mind, a way of possibly saving for the future. And we did talk about this at the National Governors Association. This was the main focus of the entire week, 2 days, I guess it was. The entire 2 days was the focus on early childhood and how we could do a better job of preparing kids for school.
Madam Chair, I don't think I spoke directly to Representative Grayling's concern about non-resident children, too. And because, again, we're talking about a mix of public and private preschools, we put this language in because, for example, if a district is going to give, let's just stick with the tuition, partial tuition for a child to go to Tudor Town, this allows then the other children in Tudor Town not to have to be in a sense segregated from the kids who are going there with the compensatory aid money. It just, because you've got, in the private system, you don't have residential requirements. Kids are coming from all over, from different neighborhoods. You can't sort of tease out the money and put it on one child and not on another child. So if you're using the compensatory money, for example, to put an extra teacher or an extra assistant into that classroom to be with the kids, the other children are benefiting too, and so we needed that language to cover that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carlson, you know, I kind of struggle with this language. We've known this has been on the horizon for months, ever since you went to the governor's conference, so we've seen this one coming. The difficult part is I'm glad to see you're supporting preschool and kids getting ready for school, but doing it this way just doesn't make sense. I mean, you're taking the pie and not adding anything to it, when really what we need to be doing is funding school readiness programs. I mean, absolutely, if we want to solve the achievement gap problem, the achievement gap starts before kids ever get to school. We know that. And I apologize if I'm repeating anything, as I was with constituents in the rotunda and in a school group. But it seems that we absolutely need to get a handle on this, but solving it by just diverting money from one pot to another, robbing one group to help another, doesn't make sense. I did want to ask a question about the private preschool part. I actually think I understand this. My son was had special needs and had to go to a private preschool that the school district did pay for. So we actually lived through that situation. What are the specifications of private preschools that will be allowed under this? I mean, in his case, there was only one that was eligible. We were basically not given a lot of choice that if to access the funds or to have the district pay for that program, he had to go to X private school. Is that the way this works?
Madam Chair and Representative Slawick, I think in your case, we're talking about early childhood special ed money being used there, and they have a criteria. There's a criteria that goes with that. This would not have to follow that criteria. Essentially, the districts themselves could decide if a particular preschool, if they wanted to contract with preschool A over preschool B, or not have a criteria that would be as stringent.
Madam Chair, Ms. Carlson, so they can go to any preschool. Will it be the district that determines that, or the parents?
Madam Chair and Representative Slawick, it'll be the district that would make. This really does put the money at the district door and the decision-making at the district door, unlike some of the decisions that are made in the school readiness program that the state makes with and for the districts in some cases.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up is, would it be, if they're contracted with different preschools, I mean, can they do different pricing and kids would be having different experiences, or is it held at a certain, is there any kind of constant for controlling quality at all?
Madam Chair and Representative Slawick, no, not in this provision. There is no state oversight over it. The district would be responsible for making its own decision on where to spend the money. Well, first of all, if they wanted to spend the money, they don't even have to do that. It's a permissive language.
So, Ms. Carlson, you're saying, though, if the district wanted to, they could just create their own preschool program. Or if they didn't want to do that, Link had a really good preschool program in their community, didn't want to create the infrastructure, they could then give the students an option of doing that, or maybe there's two or three. I can see the pros and cons on both of the situations.
And Madam Chair, how do you, Ms. Carlson, decide who gets in then? Because not everybody, there isn't enough money for everybody to get in. So it's the kids that are getting compensatory that gets in, or who gets into the program?
Madam Chair and Representative Slawick, this isn't intended to solve the problem of not having enough money for early childhood. This is just simply one more way that some money can be used and decisions can be made locally over that money.
So, Madam Chair, who gets in? The district will decide? I mean, only because obviously there isn't enough for all kids to go to school readiness programs.
Right, Madam Chair and Representative Slawick, there isn't enough money for all kids to do this. If the districts decided to spend up to the 10% allocation, we're talking about $25 million, which is a pretty good infusion of dollars into an early childhood system, but it doesn't begin to address the total need.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Carlson, so who gets in? Is there any criteria? Is it needy kids? Is it smart kids? Is it kids? Is it rich kids? Is it...
Madam Chair and Representative Slawick, you might have been out of the room when we talked about it. It is consistent with the intent. It's the kids that are underprepared to learn, which we might pick up at screening. We might not pick them up. They might get screened once they get into a program. But it is consistent with that intent, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Demmer, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This might be a global question compared to what we're talking about. We have our school readiness program for kids age 3.5 to K. We have also, and we're funding that, we also have kids in that pre-K arena being included in a student count from our general formula, and that's what's going into the transition now. And now we have this up to 10% of the compensatory monies and also the early childhood special ed monies. Is it possible that the same kids can be counted multiple times in these programs? In other words, do we have a program and we're including it under school readiness funding and they're also including them in the count for pupil count for aid from the state and now allowing these other monies to come in the same thing, and basically for a program we are hitting multiple pots to fund the program? Is that happening?
Representative Demmer, it would be possible for a child who is identified special ed to also be participating in a school readiness program and a special education early childhood program. And if we pass this, also would have some money following them that would also, be part of maybe a preschool. So, I mean, the child would probably be able to generate multiple amounts of money, possibly by virtue of maybe where they ended up going. So that if the school district was paying for early childhood special ed and that site actually happened to also house their school readiness program and that was the class where those school readiness kids were going, there could be, that they would be a beneficiary of I guess, multiple pots of money. I don't know how that sorts out, in a school district. Ms. Anderson?
Madam Chair, from just Representative Demmer, from our experience, with the St. Paul Minneapolis programs that they have that are now involved in the transition revenue, they are separate from the school readiness program. So in that case, there would be a separation. With regard to early childhood special ed, I think Representative Segrin said it well, that there's really a process involved with that. The parent needs to sit down with the school district and develop an individual education plan. It's really specialized to what the issue is with the child and what sort of services, if it's speech, if it's other things. And so it is possible there could be a special ed child in a high five program in Minneapolis, but that's, we've never felt that was inappropriate because they're trying to identify the early childhood specialized children for some of the needs that they need, and those issues are decided with the school district and the parent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, well, the focus of my question actually got changed. That was kind of an add-on, the early childhood special ed thing. I realize that could be over and above. But I guess my question really was more toward the school readiness program, which you kind of answered. The school districts that were including the pre-K kids in their student counts, that wasn't the same kids that are in the student readiness program, so not double-dipping there is what my question was. And also the 10% of compensatory that could go, would that go toward the same kids, for example, that are in the school readiness or the school readiness or the ones being counted in the pre-K, would that be going toward those so the same kids are getting money from multiple pots again? Forgetting about the specialized part.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, that's really up to the school district to decide whether or not they want to use their compensatory funds for these purposes and for them to sort out those issues. I'm not sure if the districts on with the budget constraints that they would want to use multiple funds for one child. That would probably be very inefficient for them to do that, but that would be a local decision.
Representative Demmer, I think maybe I misspoke a little bit in describing it too. Using, they have multiple pots. You might have special education, early childhood monies, and school readiness, and if we would do this compensatory, that probably would allow districts to maybe stretch the dollars out more and serve more kids because. Maybe a special ed child, like Representative Slawick's, my son too, their IEP designated that they have their early childhood special ed, which was paid for by early childhood special ed, but then as part of an inclusion model, the other half day just to a normal, typical preschool program, and they may have used some school readiness money for that pot of money, or they may have used all the special ed. I'm not quite sure how the money all is flowing, but I think, you know, it would be trying to, and that's unusual. I think that's kind of an exception. But so I think that what you would see probably is being able to access a number of different pots of money to serve more kids.
Okay, and Madam Chair, if I could, again, my question really wasn't going toward the special ed. That was a side,
yeah, right,
and
it
turned into a special ed question, and that's not what it was.
No, I know.
But I guess, quite frankly, what I was mostly concerned with is, do we have kids, and it's not about serving more kids, it's about having kids being counted in this way and counted in this, for the same kids being counted for this program and this program and this program for purpose of getting aid. So I'm using the same kid to get aid from multiple places. And special ed is different, I understand that.
Yeah.
But I was more concerned with this pupil count one and the school readiness and doubling up there. I know we're handling that through the conversion and the transition, but that was really what my question was.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, if a child in Minneapolis is in the High Five program and they're getting their transition revenue for that child, I'm not sure that they would use then the compensatory dollars to pay for that as well, since they've already got the money to pay for that child. I think Representative Segan's correct in that they would probably use the money, if they did even use the money that's permissible, to serve more children outside of the High Five program or a pre-kindergarten program. So I'm not sure if it's in the district's best interest to use different pots of money for the same children.
Ms. Gilbert actually was wanting to come up and just talk a little bit about how St. Paul uses their compensatory money. Gilbert, do you want to?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think this the whole issue arose because the school district has identified, as you know, as you've probably been told 100 times, 50% of our kindergarten kids come to us without any language skills, and many more of our children who do speak English have developmental delays. And with the whole impetus to get kids to read by the end of first grade, it's become clear to us that we have to provide more 4- and 5-year-old, frankly, we'd like to start at 3, to provide more early learning opportunities for our kids. And with this change in the interpretation of the law related to our community kindergartens and our federal Montessori programs, we had anticipated that we were going to add community kindergarten programs so that kids would be prepared to enter first grade with all the skills they needed so that they could do first grade work and be ready reading and having some reading competency by the end of first grade. We were going to increase our community kindergartens to 9 more sites, and those were sites that had all Title I kids, which meant they were very poor and they were identified as kids who definitely needed the extra time if they were going to succeed. With the change in the ruling, we were looking for some flexibility between Title I, or frankly, we're going to foundations. We're doing whatever we can to try and expand those programs so we have more kids at grade level by the time they enter first grade. And so, and to the compensatory issue, kids, the compensatory money is driven to the site, and kids who need the services, regardless of income, get those services. You know, the services are not just provided to kids who are eligible for free and reduced lunch. And then the one other thing I would like to correct is we do believe that there is a huge benefit to doing early childhood things. However, we feel that the compensatory services that we offer K through 12 are also very effective, and that the district has programs in place that are closing the achievement gap. And so we think Representative Sikora is 50% right on that, that we can demonstrate that our compensatory revenue is well spent, and that we do have lots of good data to show that if kids are in our programs at least for 3 years, that we are, in fact, closing the achievement gap. And what we use our compensatory money on is providing those extra supports that is increasing student achievement.
So, Ms. Gilbert, just to ask you a question. Representative Biskins raised the issue. You sound supportive of flexing up the compensatory to allow this use, but do we need some tightening language to clarify
Madam Chair, we certainly wouldn't object to making it clear that they were kids. Again, we were going to cite the programs at the nine Title I schools, which already, just by their nature, you know, demonstrate that they're eligible. And unfortunately, we have many more kids who actually need these services that would qualify based on their screening that we can actually serve, and then we would probably use some kind of lottery system at that point. But we have no objection to making it clear that they are for kids that have been identified that need the additional services to be grade level prepared.
Representative Bryant, you were next.
Thank you. Before Ms. Gilbert gets away, Madam Chair, I want to make clear that I think we all support early childhood programs and the getting to three-year-olds, four-year-olds, and getting them ready to read. That is I don't think anything that anyone wouldn't agree with the workshop that Representative Sikora went to. I'm just worried about the zero-sum game here, like Representative Biskins referred to earlier. To me, this is kind of like when we took some money from Head Start and put it into early childhood family education. I'm worried about the zero-sum game. But now that apparently St. Paul Public Schools is open to this, then I guess we are just giving them an option, and you can decide. So I will support this. But my question for Ms. Gilbert is, am I wrong that this is a zero-sum game? Is there 10% extra in the money that goes to the regular K through 12 students in compensatory, so we have plenty to siphon off 10% for the early childhood programs?
Madam Chair and Representative Dreiling, you're correct. I mean, what we do the allocations to the site now. All of the, you know, we do site allocations, and so there will be no more money. If a building decides to take some of its compensatory money and spend it on that, that'll be a local site decision, and we do that right now. We do per pupil allocations to the site, and we let the site, based on the school improvement plan, determine how it's going to spend the money. It doesn't add more money. It simply gives that site some opportunity to decide if it wants to, that it could spend it on that.
Representative
Daphne. I actually will take the opportunity to pass at this point.
Bless your heart.
But I'll reserve the right to change my mind.
Representative Biskins.
And I will follow the lead of my
Sikora. Me too.
Oh. Come on, Barb, you can do it. You can do it. You can do it.
Come on, Barb, put that on.
Barb. It's not on that,
Madam Chair.
Is it on this topic?
It's on that page, but it's not on that topic.
Okay, well, why don't we, as we're moving down the page, okay, then we can ask some more questions. All right.
Okay, Madam Chair, Section 23, what this does is goes back to the pre-kindergarten issue that we discussed before, the hold harmless. What this basically states is that there are no penalties for districts who have done this, and there will be no audits recapturing money that was collected on a per-pupil basis for their pre-kindergarten programs. Section 24, I'm going to give to Ms. Carlson. Those are repealers related to the school readiness statute.
Okay. You want to do the repealer? Oh, you want questions about?
Are you going to go through the repealers?
Okay. Yeah, I think we always want to go through repealers. We don't want
a lot of them.
Madam Chair and members, the repealers are all in the school readiness language, and they are repealed because the issues are still there. They're in other language now with the new amended language. The first repealer is 1.4D.15 subdivision 2 is the current child eligibility, which, again, we're not changing. We put into the on page 12, the eligibility 3.5 years old to kindergarten entrance is put in subdivision 1 there. Subdivision 4 of the repealers is the litany of program goals, which has some of that language that I referred to early on, and we are repealing that language and replacing it with the program requirements in the new subdivision, section 13, subdivision 3, which you'll find on page 13. Numbers are amazingly similar. The next repealer is subdivision 6, which is coordination with other providers language, and again we have that language addressed in on page 13 in the same subdivision 3 where we require the programs to coordinate with relevant community-based services. Section 8 is the prioritizing services language, and in the plan that I held up before, we asked the district to fill out in this prioritizing services which kind of curriculum and assessment they're using, and that then is now taken care of again on the same in the same language on page 13 in subdivision 3 where we talk about where we require the districts to conduct a child development assessment on each child. Let's see, where am I now? I'm losing my place. Subdivision 9, the child's records, is being repealed. And that was to maintain a record and show the progress of each child. And again, we have an assessment required in this new language to guide curriculum planning, and, which will become part, which is the, then part of the child's records. Section 11 is repealed, is a district standard. It's kind of awkward language where they have the school board district or the school district must develop standards for the school readiness program that reflect the eligibility criteria. And the eligibility criteria is, again, age, 3.5 to kindergarten entrance, and screening. So that's, again, already addressed in the program requirements in the new language in Subdivision 3. And Subdivision 13 was a some language that said that the districts could accept private money. They could receive money or in-kind services from a public, another public organization or private organization, and that is covered in a statute, in a general ed statute, 123D.35, that the school boards have the right to accept money. So we got rid of that language, too. We're really trying to save trees here. 1.4D.16, subdivision 1 in the aid section, we repeal the language about the program review and approval because, again, that's covered in on the bottom of page 13 in section 14, subdivision 3A in the application requirements. And subdivision 4 in the 8th section required the districts to put the money they receive from us in a separate account within the Fund 4 accounts, and that was that's proposed to be repealed because last year we had new reserve account language that supersedes that old separate account language anyway. So that's kind of a cleanup. And then the 2003 supplement language is the advisory council language, and we now cover that. Actually, we made the parent language a little stronger in this new language. We require, again, as a program requirement, let me find it here, that we involve that the districts involve parents in program planning and decision making, which is, I think, stronger language than having them merely advise as a part of an advisory council. It also however the districts want to do that, they will give us a plan, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to sit as a council together on a regular basis. They've got some better idea on how to have parents make decisions about the programs. We're willing to look at those plans with them as part of their requirements. I think that's all of them. Did I get all of them?
All right, Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, in the language on page 13 and 14, and maybe I'm just not, oh, actually, it's only 13. There's several sections here that in this program, school readiness, you used to have quite a bit of language about the parental involvement and that the program must include that. And that language is all deleted in here. Is it somewhere else, or am I missing something, or are we just saying that's not an important criteria for program eligibility? Or
Madam Chair, that's what I was just referring to. I think actually, if you look at lines 16 and 17 on page 13, that's where the parent decision-making language is. We've had a lot of kind of, you know, parent involvement best practice over the years has really kind of shifted from what we used to involve parents in, you know, maybe in a kind of a traditional sense about them coming into the classroom or coming into the program. We really have gone from that to more than involvement, but that they should have decision-making authority, if you will, in the program planning and the carrying out of the activities. So we're trying to make that stronger. If you don't think we succeeded in that, we'd be willing to entertain different language or additional language.
Madam Chair, I just didn't make that connection. I heard you say the change there, but I didn't see that on this page originally. So that's good. I think that's a good change.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I think we're finished with review of this document. Representative Slower.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just have to ask a question.
Sorry. Is this on the school readiness again?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
19.
I did forget, we do have Article 5, which just has to do with the permanent school trust fund. We have to just look at that real quick. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, I just had a comment. I mean, it's just more out of frustration. You know, in the yellow book, the permanent rules of the House, it says that the governor's bills are supposed to be given their first reading at least 10 days before the date of the first committee deadline. And here we get this yesterday. And for those of us that are passionate and caring about early childhood, I'm having a lot of trouble following this and what's really in there. And I would just encourage the department and the governor's office to give us enough time to look at this to see what's really in there. We are changing a lot of stuff here. I'll trust you. Ms. Carlson, I worked with you for a long time. I'm hoping I can trust you. But the language changes are far-reaching, significant, and I can't track all this, frankly. You know, and if I can't track it, the public probably can't track it. And we're going on a process that is just going to go the way it is. But why didn't we have this when we were supposed to have this, which is 10 days before the first committee deadline, which would have been about, 2 weeks ago?
Ms. Anderson, can you give us any reasons why this took a while to get here?
Madam Chair, Representative Slawick, I think the delay was just the governor decided not to have a budget out until after the February forecast and to make final decisions on the budget after the forecast was released. Just because there was some concern that the forecast would have showed larger deficits than it did. And I think the delay is just directly related to that.
Madam Chair. Just a follow-up. However, a lot of this is, I think almost everything in the early childhood is almost policy changes. Was there any thought that we would see the policy changes before the fiscal changes?
Madam Chair, Representative Slawick, there's a lot of discussion of that internally. I think there's just concern upon others that would not release not put anything in the policy bill that might have any fiscal impact, and there was concern that this language might have fiscal impact and in some respects with the compensatory changes, even though there's no net change, there was a feeling that we needed to hold all anything that might have make any changes fiscally.
Madam Chair, just
Ms. Anderson, excuse me. Was that more the Department of Finance's direction to make sure that happened?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
Just a Madam Chair, just one last comment on that. You know, I think one thing we all probably do agree on is we're all for good government. I mean, I really think we do want the best thing, particularly in education. I mean, this is the heart of what government's all about, is providing a good education for our kids. And I just hope in the future that we'll follow the rules and get the bills out on time.
And Representative Slaw, we don't have to do any of this if we don't want to. I mean, I wanted to give the governor the courtesy of hearing this document. And if we had I was concerned that there may be some technical things in here that we needed to take care of that they found. And sometimes that does happen, too, that as we go forward, there are things at the last minute. And I did want to get this out, you know, as far as. And if there was some things in here that, although late, if we think that they're worthy of discussion, then, you know, we should try to consider. But we can certainly, all of these things are good ideas. We can postpone them until next year if we really feel that, you know, we want more time to kind of digest them and make sure that there's more. And we will take some we'll take some testimony here in a minute from the public on it, too. But certainly, you know, if it's the will of the committee that they feel uncomfortable with some of this stuff, we just, you know, we won't do it. And we'll have that discussion in a minute. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to point out a concern I have. When we have the AYP list and school districts don't respond within 30 days, and Commissioner Yecky rules, they don't respond within 30 days to show the error to the Department of Education, then Commissioner Yecky or the staff there rules that, too bad, you're on AYP list, even though you shouldn't be on it, but because they didn't appeal within the 30 days, they got stuck on the list. So it's really not showing accurate information, but to hold school districts accountable to respond within 30 days and putting them on an AYP list and giving their school a 2-star when they probably should have been a 5-star seems quite odd when you guys weren't able to meet the deadline of this committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, I do want to say that that 30-day window, if it was an error made by the department or a vendor, we granted them appeal. If it was an error by the school district, then we did not.
That's my point, Madam Chair.
Let's see, now we are you going to do the permit school custom?
Madam Chair, actually, no, we wanted to take up contracting. We were going to take that up earlier, and then Representative Goodwin.
Can we wait on that just
sure.
a minute? We do have on Article 5. This will not actually be carried in our bill. It will be in the DNR bill. That's why you've got this Environment and Natural Resources. But we wanted to look it over because we want to change the language somewhat, and I have been working with the DNR on that. And Mr. Crow, do you want to just explain that, or Mr. Strom, either one?
Madam Chair and members, it's on page 2, lines, section 7, lines 21 to 30. What this does is appropriate $50,000 from the forest expense account, and basically it allows the Department of Natural Resources to identify, evaluate, and lease construction aggregates that are on school trust lands. And this $50,000 appropriation basically comes out of the principal of the trust fund. Doesn't come out of the principal, but it's money that would be transferred to the principal if we don't make this appropriation. And ultimately, after 3 years, in the third year, in fiscal 2007, the permanent school fund will show an increase in revenue because of this, greater than the loss from the appropriation because of the income from the aggregates that will be leased, or the aggregates will be sold from that leased land. And there is an amendment to clean up the appropriation a bit, and I'm not sure where that's at. Oh, yeah, we'll take that up on Monday when we hear that.
Oh, okay. That the amendment to this will be taken up on Monday, so we'll have that. And basically what it will say is that the department will have 3 years of appropriation through 2007, and then they have to come back again for more monies. Mm-hmm. All right. But we'll discuss it. Are you're looking for the
correct time to Madam Chair, they need the money to evaluate the value of leasing.
Madam Chair, Representative Daly, they need to evaluate the actual property and figure out where there are places where they're doing drilling and core sampling,
okay.
Surveying the
yeah.
The state yeah. lands to find out where there's some gravel and
yeah.
I'll try to pay more attention to aggregate in the future.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
It is.
Okay, just wanted to give you that heads up. And before we go on to the contracting, too, I wanted to invite the public to come down before we move on. Is there anyone in the public that would like to comment on any of the sections of the governor's document? Concerns, questions, support, neutral, any questions? Representative Slavik?
Madam Chair, you said we're going to be taking public testimony?
I just said today we would take some public testimony. I said that. Yep, I said that yesterday also. I had said, you know, we'd be glad to take public testimony.
Did anybody offer to give public testimony?
No, have not had any. But anybody that's here is certainly.
There's movement.
Mr. Grathwell, there's movement. Come on down.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Grathwell, Minneapolis Public Schools. Thanks for the opportunity. I do want to speak to the transition aid solution for the Hi-Fi in Minneapolis, the Hi-Fi kindergarten program. We're trying to solve the problem of closing the achievement gap in Minneapolis. That's been a very effective tool, and we'd like to continue to use it and expand it. We believe we're running that program kind of with the knowledge and consent of the department. We had a memo on that later at the end of last year. So we'd like to thank the department, the governor, and certainly the committee and chair for working with us on this solution for that problem. On the flexibility of use of compensatory revenue, I think there's two issues there also. I'd never argue against flexibility. This committee and early childhood committees in the Senate are working on how do we address making good investments early where we don't have a E-12 system entirely in place. So we do have kind of patchwork of early childhood family education, early childhood special education, learning readiness. Everybody does these things differently, but I think we're probably coming closer together to putting something in place, and still it's a zero-sum game. So a certain pat of butter only goes so far on a piece of bread. We're not serving all the kids we can. Having greater flexibility, I'd never argue against flexibility. You always hear school districts come up and say, don't force us to do things. But we will wind up making Sophie's choices, and you folks, using your Solomonic wisdom, are always making those choices between what programs to fund, and that means you're not funding something else. But we have 12th graders who haven't passed the basic skills test. We have kids in early childhood who aren't ready to enter kindergarten or first grade. And then thanks again also for the correction or the fix on the homeless transportation. That's going to help a lot. You'll become more and more aware over time if you're near the center city and have a district that there's something new in federal law, part of No Child Left Behind, called McKinney-Vento. Your school districts are struggling with a new transportation mandate for homeless. And it's, you know, mandates are always good ideas to serve kids. We have, was speaking with a Hi-Fi teacher yesterday who's serving a kid in one of our Hi-Fi programs who by March 19th or whatever we're at today, has worked with a kid who's lived in 3 shelters and 2 apartments already this year. That kid has only missed 2 days of his Hi-Fi program during the course of the year. We have lots of mobility. We're doing lots of transportation. That little piece helps out a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have some minutes to approve the March 17th minutes. Someone like to move those?
I'll move.
Representative Goodman moves the March 17th minutes. Any additions or corrections? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposition? The minutes are approved. And then we have the March 18th. Representative Erickson moves those. Any additions or corrections? Not all in favor?
Aye.
Opposition? Minutes are approved. Okay, now we want to get back to the... Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify before we go on? Okay. We want to get back to the contracting issue. Representative Goodwin had requested that the department give us a summary of their contracting or contracts and what they're kind of used for. And we've got a handout here.
Yeah, Madam Chair, while that's being handed out, I have an answer to Representative Erickson's earlier question.
Okay.
The salaries of the executive, the salary of the executive director of the Board of Teaching currently is $84,585. The salary of the Board of School Administrator Executive Director is $66,064, although he works 70% of the time, so he's not completely full-time.
Madam Chair.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, who monitors the expenditures of these two boards to ensure that the expenditures do not outstrip the fees taken in?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, that would be the responsibility of the Executive Director. Ms. McGlone, did you want to go on? Who's presenting this?
Madam Chair, I can do that.
Okay.
What we have here is a list of all of our contracts on federal funds, general fund, and any special revenue funds. We've listed this list by vendor name. We ran the fiscal year 03 expenditures. We have fiscal year 04. Those are estimated numbers. They're not final numbers because we've not completed the fiscal year. And on the list, we have the purpose of the contract. I'm not sure if you want me to go through every single one on the list. If there are selected ones you'd like me to do, that's fine. Generally, our largest contracts, as I said before, are testing contracts. We have a contract with Data Recognition Corporation, as you'll see there.
What page is that on?
On page 2. It's the third from the bottom.
Okay.
As you'll see there, in fiscal year 03, it was just over $4 million on the general fund, which is a separate appropriation from our state agency. It's not part of our agency funds. And then on the federal funds, it was just over $1 million. If you look on 04, the 200 account is, there's a number of non-public schools that take the basic skills test, which is one of the contracts that tests that DRC administers. And they pay for that contract, and the department collects that fee and then pays the vendor for that service. The other testing companies would be Harcourt Educational Measurement on page 3. It's the third one from the bottom as well. That is a new contract that's completely federally funded. I should mention DRC has the contracts for grades 3, 5, 7, reading and math, and the basic skills test. Harcourt has the new contract. It's federally funded because it's required under No Child Left Behind that we have tests in grades 3 through 8 for reading and math. They have the contracts for grades 4, 6, and 8 for reading and math. That test is in development right now and is being field tested this spring. The next contract we have is with NCS Pearson. That's on page 5. It's also the third from the bottom. They administer the grades 10 and 11 tests for the department. The other one is actually MetriTech. That is on also page 5. It's the third one from the top. They administer the T-test, which is a test given to limited English proficient students.
So those are, Ms. Anderson, those are kind of the big chunks. Is that kind of the 80% of your contracting, or what percentage of your contracting is that?
If you look at page 8, it's the total of our contracts. By far, it's the largest portion. Almost all of our general fund is the testing. Federal funds, we do more contracting on the federal fund than we do general fund, but as you can see from fiscal year 03 to 04, our overall numbers on contracting has remained pretty stable.
So the Ms. Anderson, the difference though between 03 and 04, I'm just looking at the $11 million versus the $8 million, is that because some of the federal money is covering some of that testing, or what, or it's just you just reduced some of the contracting?
Madam Chair, I think why you see a little difference there is just kind of how we paid the non-publics, and we had some reductions as well on the general fund to manage our agency funds, but it might be just a reflection of when we pay the non-public portion of the testing.
Okay. All right. So are there any questions then on the contracting, Representative Goodwin?
no surprises there. Thanks, Madam Chair. Okay, I got lots of questions. Okay, so the total amount for 04 is $17.3 million, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Goodman, that's a projection.
That's the encumbered.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you've got $17.6 million for 03.
Madam Chair, Representative Goodman, that's correct.
And no, okay, so together that's $35 million, basically. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're spending about $35 million in consultant contracts. In addition to that, I assume the grant programs, the non-district grants, how much do we spend in non-district grants?
Madam Chair, Representative Goodman, we'd have to pull that number. We
okay.
Have it here.
What point, Representative Goodman, what do you mean by non-district grants?
One way to get, one way that agencies use to get around the having contracts is to go through the grant system, to get work done through a grant rather than through a contract. So that's really important to know both what the non-district grants are in addition to, in for education, for the Department of Education, non-district grants in addition to the contracting money, just so you can really get an idea of how much the money is not going directly to the school districts.
Okay.
And what percentage of the budget that we appropriate that
okay.
is.
Can you get that information for us? Is that possible?
Madam Chair, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And we do send grants to, most of our grants to school districts or service co-ops for education, or education districts for services. Special ed is one where the service co-ops do a lot of low incidence work for the department.
But those are for school districts. I think she was talking about non-district.
Yeah, and we Madam Chair, we can send you the entire list.
Okay, that's fine. Do you have any kind of ballpark figures to what that would be?
Madam Chair, I'd be
okay.
It'd be probably wrong for me to speculate.
Okay.
So.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Goodman.
Madam Chair, so another question is, why doesn't the federal government pay for our testing, since testing is such an important part of NCLB? Why are it's all general fund money, this $21 million here?
Madam Chair, Representative Goodwin, what the federal government doesn't like to do is supplant. And if the state already had tests online that the state paid for, they're not. They generally do not like to supplant federal money for that state money. We all the time we do are in contact with the feds and what's allowable and what's not allowable. And as much as possible, we do want to spend federal dollars. But we do have to recognize there are also limited federal dollars out there. And so, if we spend federal dollars, you know, for we still need to pay for the 4, 6, and 8 math and reading tests and for the science tests. And there's a limited pot of federal dollars to do that, so we have to manage those funds as well.
Ms. Anderson, though, didn't we, under No Child Left Behind, though, we were getting $6 or $8 million for testing.
Yes, we are.
Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, and so, but that money is being paid for the 4, 6, 8, and what other?
It pays for the T-test, and it'll pay for the science test.
Okay, and but so the science tests at those interval grades, and then the 4, 6, 8 in reading and math is also being paid for by the feds.
Yes.
And that's like $8 million that the feds are paying, or somewhere around there.
This year, those tests are costing us about $4 million. That number will increase slightly because we need to, they're not fully operational yet. They're in development and field testing. And so we believe our federal funds will pay for we'll pay for the 4, 6, and 8 reading and math tests. We'll pay for the science development and administration of those tests, three tests from grades
and
8 through 12, and the T test.
And then there sounds like will there be a little money left over? And if that money is left over, does that go to help pay for the costs of the tests then to be like given to the kids?
Yeah. What the federal government has told us, Madam Chair, is that money left over can be used for testing. Can be used for state testing, but you first need to pay for your tests that you need to come online. Mm-hmm. And at this point, we're estimating that we just have enough to pay for 4, 6, and 8 reading and math, for the science test, and for the T test.
And
Ms. Anderson, once those tests are online, though, I'm assuming that we're are we going to still continue to get that amount of money and then eventually can be switched over to pay for some of the tests?
Madam Chair, you know, we expect to get the $6.3 million every year unless Congress makes a decision otherwise to increase or decrease that number. And so we need to, you know, we need to spend those monies first on our federal tests, and if we have money left over, then we could. But at this point, we don't feel that there's going to be a lot of excess money to pay for our state tests.
Not at least in the short term.
Not in the short term, Madam Chair.
But maybe in the long term, if this possibly.
And, Madam Chair, it's going to be, you know, probably till 2006, 2007 until we have our program fully operational. At that point, we'd have to reevaluate where we're at.
Okay. But at my age, that's, you know, short term. Representative Goodwin.
And Madam Chair, last year when we got the budget projections for the next 2 years, the amount of contracting that the Department of Education had said they were going to be doing was a total of about $15 million, I believe. And then you corrected that in committee last year and said you thought it would be more like $25 million. And here we now are at $35 million. And that's a significant amount of money more. I'm wondering a couple of things about the, because yesterday I asked you about the offshore outsourcing of any of these contracts, and you said you'd contacted your vendors, and they said there weren't any. I look at this list here, though, and I see companies on this list that do outsource offshore outsourcing. I don't know whether or not they do our projects offshore, but they definitely do a considerable amount of offshore outsourcing. So that concerns me. And I also wanted to know if you knew if how much of this amount of $35 million total for this biennium was in out-of-state companies. How many of these entities that you're contracting with are not, how much of this money is not remaining in Minnesota, I guess is my question. Because I think that's is an important question now as the offshore outsourcing when we have such a job shortage in the state of Minnesota.
Okay, Ms. Anderson, we've got two questions, offshore and out of state.
Madam Chair, Representative Goodwin, when we surveyed our vendors, we didn't ask them, do you do offshore work? We asked them, on our contracts, are you doing offshore? And the answer we got was no. So there, when I said no, I meant on the contracts we have with the companies, not whether or not they generally do any work offshore. And then on the out-of-state, we'd have to go through and evaluate, you know, where is the companies in-state or out-of-state. I can tell you from our larger contracts, the testing companies, Data Recognition Corporation is located in Minnesota in Maple Grove. MCS Pearson had headquarters in Minnesota. They still have some here, but they're located in Iowa City. And Harcourt is located, has corporate headquarters in Florida.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have another question. Mm-hmm. One of the comments and complaints that I've heard often is that with several departments, but with yours as well, is that a number of these contracts are not put out for bid for an RFP on the state register so that there's open competitive bidding for these contracts. If we cross-check the list, the state register, how many of these are would we find that were actually went out for bid? I mean, how many would, what percentage? I looked at one point, and I believe it was something like 5% of all the contracts in the state had ever been put out for bid. And I thought that was an unbelievable number, but I cross-checked the companies we dealt with and the agency contracts with the state register for an entire year and all the contracts we put out, and it was like 5% of the contracts we put out. And I know that at that time, the Department of Education was particularly guilty of not putting out RFPs and not allowing competition and just assigning these contracts, which I think is a could be a very expensive way of doing business. And so I'm wondering, that's what my question is. I see some on the list here that I don't know if they ever got bid out. So what's
Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Goodwin, we would have to go back and tell you which one of these contracts are sole source versus were put out for an RFP. I don't have that information right now.
That is an additional problem, is that way too often, at MnDOT, I guess it was 60% of 65% of the contracts that were called sole source, and I have a hard time believing that nobody else can do that many of the state's contracts. And I believe that, and I've heard actually from the Department of Administration that the Department of Education is particularly high on the sole sourcing non-competitive bidding issues, so I have a lot of concerns about the expenditure of money and the waste of money that's going on doing business that way. I talk about this year after year, I know that, but I don't see any improvements, and I see extreme increases, like a $10 million increase. What is that 30% increase in 1 year, from 1 year to the next, and the amount that you say you're going to contract out compared to the amount you're actually contracting out? And at the same time, I see our school district struggling, so I have a lot of trouble with this. And now we're finding out that the department is appropriating federal NCLB funds for reading programs in a way that I don't think is helping our students. And he has again been sending that money not to the K-12 system, but in this case to the higher ed system. So I'm really I don't like the idea that we have to take cuts here, and that the more programs are being cut, nothing's added back into early childhood, and we've got this much money going out and without any real good information about the results of this, of these expenditures.
Ms. Anderson, maybe you can get the what did you call it? The non-district.
Yeah.
Madam Chair,
information. And Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, I think that on the individual names you see there, most of those folks are hearing officers or mediators in our special ed. And we really, number one, we have to have hearing officers to have hearings and to lay out the issues that are going on in school districts of the state. And the mediators are important because we've really put an emphasis on going to mediation before going to court and special ed. Many times the department is party of a defendant along with the school district in a lawsuit, and admin is, as far as I understand, on the hearing officers approved under a blanket sole source for a number of hearing officers to conduct those hearings. They're very specialized. You need to have people who understand special ed rules to conduct those hearings. And so you'll see a number of names that they're hearing officers. They're approved under a sole source by the Department of Administration because of their expertise. Another thing, too, is that we have to hire a lot of expert witnesses for legal cases we have in special ed. We have probably half a dozen lawsuits that that we need to have expert witnesses, and we don't necessarily we know who the experts are that are going to represent the state and some of our special ed rules, and we don't necessarily request an RFP because we know who the experts are. There's a very small field, and we don't necessarily have time to go through an RFP process when we have to go to court to defend the state. So a number of the names you see, those are specifically reasons why we've directly contracted with those folks.
Ms. Anderson, but it would be helpful, too, to get also the your bidding process and how many of these things actually went out to bid. There are a lot of website development and technology things here, too, and I know that the department doesn't have a lot of internal IT people, and that is a very limited department, and it's overstressed and whatever. But, you know, if you can, you know, just get us some of that. I think Representative Goodwin makes some good points. We want to make sure that there's sunshine on the process, and we appreciate it. It looks to me like a lot of the bigger increase in from 03 to 04 has been the additional $4 million for federal money. I mean, that federal money is included in the state thing for the testing, and then there's some other kind of, and then the testing for the other companies has gone up somewhat, too. So I think that absorbs quite a chunk of that increase, but then there are other things. And so Representative Goodwood brings up good points. I don't think anybody's trying to question anyone's behavior or judgment, but just to get some additional information and trying to make sure that we've got RFP process in place and
and the information that we need.
Madam Chair, we will provide that to the committee.
All right, thank you. Representative Goodwin, one more follow-up?
Yeah, one more follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing I've asked in the past from the department that I have yet to receive is the travel expenses, conference expenses, food expenses. I was told that the department spends a lot of money, and this is not recently, it was last year, on ordering food for their administrative staff and so forth. And I've asked for that, and they say, oh, no, we don't do that. But I got it from some very reliable sources that that's kind of an ongoing thing. So if you could get us information, and I think, again, that should be open, about the travel, the conferences that are gone to, and the hotels that are rented for different kinds of functions that the department has, and catering bills and that type of thing, I would really like to see that as well. Thank you.
Representative Goodwin, I do have an anecdotal story about that for this administration. I know that they have really reined in their seminars and you know, going to other places, to the extent that some of the resorts where they used to get this business are complaining that they're not getting any business anymore because they're holding all of their conferences over at the Roseville Conference Center, which I think is very appropriate. You know, if we've got a conference center, we probably should keep our conferences there. We've got a facility, but we've got resort owners that are complaining that the department isn't spending any money on those issues. So I think the department has actually reined in a lot of that at a time when we have a fiscal situation here that we need to be prudent. They're doing that, but I'm sure they'll be glad to give information. Representative Garland, you have a question, and then it looks like it's probably almost time for lunch.
Madam Chair, I'm ready for lunch, but okay. I do have one question, and I thank you for taking the time to go through this, because when we are nickel and diming the schools as well as the legislators being able to go to conferences, I hope we're doing that very stringently in our agencies as well. My one question is a $500,000 appropriation to St. Thomas University.
Which page are you
on? Page 6.
Okay.
I'm wondering if that was a sole source or if, for instance, the University of Minnesota had a chance to bid on that one.
Madam Chair, Representative Bryland, this is what I know about this one. I don't know about every single one on the list, but this one used to be done as a grant, and there was concern within the department that it should not be done as a grant, that perhaps that it should be a contract. And my understanding that this has been done for years, and it was then switched it to a contract, and it was done this year as a sole source contract.
Hey, well, Madam Chair,
Representative,
that's the sort of thing that does concern me, because we already have the Office of Educational Accountability at the university, and I think when we're spending $500,000, we should be getting bids, including from our public institutions who already have some of this set up, and then, you know, maybe it would be cheaper. And not even to find out if it's cheaper when that's the largest thing on this list. And we have cut early childhood and family education and Head Start and things that we talked about this morning that really make a difference really concerns me. So I appreciate the time spent here, and I hope we can spend some more time.
I don't think, Representative, this is the largest thing on the list. We've got some other. Meritech is, I think, larger. No, I'm sorry. You're right. Largest non-testing one you're talking about. Yeah, okay.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right, thank you. And those are points well made. You know, I'm sure the department will take those very seriously, and we appreciate the time, Ms. Anderson, for coming today. And this meeting is adjourned. Also.